What do the Marx Brothers have in common with Louis C.K.? What does Larry David have in common with Milton Berle? What do Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller have in common with Robert Smigel and Conan O'Brien and Ellen DeGeneres and Don Rickles? The answer, they are all included in the one-century history of comedy in my next guest's book. The book is called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. It's compiled by Cliff Nesteroff, who joins me now. Hi, Cliff. How are you?
I'm great, Paul.
That is a major undertaking, but something that you've made kind of your life's passion for quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's really been an outgrowth of my work online that I did with my website, Classic Television Showbiz, which I had been doing for a long time, which you can tell if you go to the website Classic Television Showbiz, because the website looks like it's from 2002.
In reading your book, I was reminded of my youth spent listening to a lot of comedy albums from George Carlin and Robert Klein and Albert Brooks and Richard Pryor. And then it occurred to me, there is no such thing anymore as the comedy album, is there?
Well, not really. Although, you know, a comedy is something that goes through cycles. So you could compare the comedy record boom of the late 50s and early 60s to the podcast boom of today, just as it was unusual for a comedian not to have a comedy record in the early 60s. Today it seems unusual if a comedian doesn't have their own podcast. So one form has just been replaced or supplanted with another.
Although the podcast, and in particular Marc Maron, probably the most famous podcast by a comedian, his WTF podcast, that's not really his act. That's really him either ranting about things or interviewing other comedians, right?
That's true. That's a good point. But if we go to the comedy record craze, if you listen to the comedy records of Jackie Vernon, on those he sings a humorous version of the Beatles song Yesterday. A laugh track is added. Some comedians in the early 60s, their comedy records have them doing sketches rather than stand-up. So, you know, all the mediums, sometimes people toy with it a little bit or tweak it a little bit. So even the comedy record boom wasn't necessarily always somebody's stand-up act. And in the cases of people like Lenny Bruce, his comedy records are not even indicative of what he was doing on stage, because he couldn't really have what he was doing on stage recorded in that era. You know, it simply wasn't allowed. So even the Lenny Bruce records are a sanitized version of what his live stand-up act was.
Who was the first comic to make an album?
Well, as far as stand-up comedy is concerned, Red Fox was the very first person to come out with a comedy record. Prior to that, there had been novelty records by Stan Freberg, Spike Jones and his City Slickers, and in the 20s and 30s, radio shows like Sam and Henry had been pressed to 78. But Red Fox was the very first person to put out a stand-up comedy record in 1956, and he does not get the credit for that. Mort Saul often takes credit and says that I was the first person with a comedy record. Shelley Berman sometimes says that he was the first person with a comedy record. But Mort Saul's first record came out in 58. Shelley Berman's first record came out in 59. Red Fox's first comedy record came out in 1956, and it was so successful that his record label, Duto Records, put out 14 Red Fox comedy records, 10 LPs, and 4 EPs between 1956 and 1958 before anybody else had one. And he never gets the credit, but Red Fox was the very first comedian to simply have his stand-up act recorded and pressed on vinyl.
Yeah, long before anybody would know him from Sanford and Son, he was doing these things, direct recordings of his stand-up. And the amazing thing to me about this is none of these records could have been played on the radio. Later, there were people who produced comedy specifically for the radio, and there were some comedians whose stuff you could slip in without endangering your FCC license. That was not true of anything Red Fox ever did, was it?
Well, not really. I mean, if we listen to his records today, of course, though, they seem very tame. So I don't know that it wasn't like George Carlin's Seven Words You Can't Say on Television, but a lot of times the subject matter, you're right, could not be played on the radio, and a lot of these records were pressed with a disclaimer right on the back cover that said not suitable for airplay, a warning, a cautionary warning for disc jockeys, don't play these on the air or you might lose your job. But really, when you listen to what they're saying on some of those records, it's not the F word. There were other so-called party albums by people like Rusty Warren and Woody Woodbury, and they were using phrases like knockers, and that was considered taboo. You can't play it on the air because of the word knockers. So it was just a different time, of course.
Yeah, and when you call them party records, people would buy one and invite all their friends over and listen to it, and then have another party and listen to it again.
Yeah, I mean, that was the story. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. I was theorizing about this the other day. I think maybe the reason that the moniker party records was used initially was not because people were playing them at parties and having a fun time sitting around in their living room drinking cocktails and listening to the latest comedy record. Of course, that was the theory, that you could recreate the atmosphere of a nightclub in the comfort of your own home. But Red Fox's very first series of comedy records were called Laugh of the Party. And like I say, since Red Fox came out with 14 comedy releases before anybody else, that phrase may have spawned from that. Laugh of the Party, Volume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 were Red Fox's first 10 albums. So perhaps, I'm theorizing, the phrase party record may have been shorthand for Red Fox.
Yeah, makes sense. I wish I had been born a few years earlier than I was so that I could have gone to Las Vegas in its heyday and seen people like Buddy Hackett and Sammy Davis Jr. on stage. You write in the book about the influence Vegas had on the careers of many comedians, and particularly the influence of a Vegas run by the mafia, right?
Well, of course. I mean, in those days, I guess most people know, of course, that Las Vegas had a mafia connection, but every nightclub in America did, and Las Vegas was really built as a way to avoid regional harassment by law enforcement when the mob was set up in Cleveland, Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Miami Beach. All over America, there were different mob factions, and they ran nightclubs in every city in America. And, of course, stand-up comedians performed in these nightclubs. So the boss for most stand-up comics throughout the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, 9 times out of 10, was a mobster. But in the early 50s, when Senator Kefauver of Tennessee took it as his banner cause to drive out organized crime from America, which kind of culminated with the famous trials in New York where Frank Costello was grilled by this committee, and it was televised, and he refused to have his face shown on TV, so they focused in on his trembling hands instead, and it became almost like this expressionist flourish on early television. The local law enforcement in all these cities were embarrassed because there was an expose about how these police officers were on the take, how mobsters were running these cities, how everybody was in the pocket of the mob. And so in response to that, local officials started harassing mob-owned entities. They started to bust certain nightclubs or shut them down or raid the gambling rooms. And this harassment amplified to the extent that the mob got so annoyed by it that they decided eventually to pick up all their chips and move to Las Vegas, where the law enforcement was extremely lax and gambling laws had been eased. So that kind of helped build Las Vegas. And, of course, the mob ran Vegas. But prior to Vegas, they ran almost every city in America, especially Florida. Miami Beach was really Las Vegas before Las Vegas, with tons of hotels, girls, shows, gambling. And there wasn't a comedian alive in the 1940s that didn't aspire to headline Miami Beach. And that's kind of a forgotten and lost cause. And in fact, if you look at some of those early comedy records, by Woody Woodbury, Rusty Warren, people like that, so many of them are recorded from venues in Miami Beach.
Are there comedians whose names we would know whose careers were either made or broken by mob bosses?
Well, yeah, maybe the most famous for your audience, the one that is still the most tangible that people know, is Don Rickles.
Really?
Yeah, and I know that surprises a lot of people. If you read Don Rickles' memoir, he talks mostly about Frank Sinatra's connections to the mob, and Rickles jokes about that all the time. But he seldom mentions that he, too, was mob-connected. For years, Don Rickles was managed by a guy named Willie Weber in the late 40s and throughout the early 50s. And Willie Weber was sort of like the poor man's manager. He would take on any comedian who could not find an agent or a manager. So he mostly managed these schlubs, these losers, guys with obscure names today like Pat Henry, who was an opening act for Stephen Eady, and a guy named Eddie White, and a guy named Mickey Shaughnessy, who turned into a character actor later. But he also managed Don Rickles. And Willie Weber, just incidentally, is the grandfather of Stephen Weber, the star of the sitcom Wings.
Ah.
Anyways, Willie Weber managed Don Rickles till 1957. And he had him booked in a place called the Elegante in Ocean Parkway, Brooklyn. And that club was managed by a guy named Joe Scandori and his family, the Scandori family, who were part of a cardboard box manufacturing empire. That's how they made their money, and they owned this nightclub. And when Joe Scandori saw Don Rickles come through the club, he loved him. He thought he was the funniest guy ever. And he said, you know, I'm kind of sick of managing this nightclub. I would like to manage you. And Don Rickles said, well, I already have a manager named Willie Weber. And Joe Scandori said, yeah, you may already have a manager, but do you have connections? The Scandoris were connected to the Vito Genovese crime family, one of the major five crime families of New York. And so he signed with Joe Scandori, and he paid a visit to Willie Weber. Scandori said, your client, Don Rickles, we're managing him now. And Willie Weber said, no, I have three more years to go with my contract on Don Rickles. And Scandori said, no, you don't. And Willie Weber said, yeah, I do. And Scandori said, trust me, no, you don't. And so Rickles broke the contract. The mob took over his career. And if you read Rickles' memoir, he says, Willie Weber was very good to me, but it was time to move on.
Uh-huh.
No hard feelings. But when I was doing my research, I found court documents in which Willie Weber sued Don Rickles for breach of contract, and it was in New York Supreme Court, but then the lawsuit was mysteriously dropped.
Hmm.
There was no follow-up with it. But they built a nightclub for Don Rickles in Miami Beach, a bunch of sort of low-level mobster point men in Miami Beach were assigned to build this room called the Riot Room. It was adjacent to a motor inn called the Admiral V Motel. They built it just for Don Rickles as a showcase, the mob.
Wow.
And that's sort of where he started to make his name as the insult comic. From there, they sent him to Los Angeles, where, according to Mickey Cohen's autobiography, the famous Hollywood mobster Mickey Cohen, they helped him get gigs there. And slowly but surely, Don Rickles enjoyed a big rise. And a couple years later, he was booked into the Sahara Hotel. And that's where he became a lounge comedian, and that's really where he found his voice. And that's where that famous Frank Sinatra story comes from, where he walks through the room and Rickles yells out, Frank Sinatra, make yourself at home, hit somebody. That famous line.
Yep.
That came from when he started doing the lounge at the Sahara. So Don Rickles, for all intents and purposes, I shouldn't say necessarily that he owes his career to the mob, but perhaps he owes his fame to the mob.
And while we're on Rickles, I don't want this all to be about him. Is it true that he was actually very insecure and afraid that he was hurting people's feelings?
Yeah, he was. He was and is a very sensitive man, a very friendly man. And the whole thing he does still to this day of apologizing at the end of his act was born out of fear that he was actually hurting people's feelings. Because the whole insult shtick was not created because he's a mean guy. It came out of just sort of happenstance. He had been a dramatic actor, graduating from the Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York in 1956. One of his classmates in that graduating class was Jason Robards. And so he wanted to be just a thespian. When he started doing comedy in nightclubs, he didn't have an act, so he did dramatic monologues that he was equipped with from school. And of course, when you're playing a nightclub full of drunks, they don't want to listen to a dramatic monologue. And people started heckling him. And slowly but surely, Don Rickles started responding to those hecklers. And that's how the insult shtick was born.
Gotcha. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Cliff Nesteroff, whose book is called The Comedians, a wonderful book at looking back at a century of comedy and the people who have performed it, both male and female. I mentioned in the introduction Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller. I think it's amazing that we've gotten up to the year 2015 and had a complete changeover of all of the late-night television shows, and still not one of them on the big networks is hosted by a woman. You've got Chelsea Handler, who had one on E! For a few years. Samantha Bee is going to start her new late-night show on TBS in January. But in a world of Jimmy's and the rest, are you surprised that we haven't had a woman break through to that level yet?
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, that is sort of one of the dark histories of show business, is that women often lose out, and now we have more women in comedy than ever before. And I think that old, tired axiom that is always rearing its ugly head about women not being funny is now dead. We all know how many funny women are in the business now, so I think it's just a matter of time. I'm not surprised, but it is kind of sad that it has taken this long.
Speaking of late-night TV, has there ever been anybody as powerful in that realm as Lorne Michaels?
That's a good question. I mean, he really, really is a powerful man. But it's interesting. His power really exploded in recent history. His power, as popular and important as SNL was in 1975 and those first 5 years, when he left the show in 1980, he was no longer a powerful man. He regrouped and did a show called The New Show that some comedy fans might remember. It featured people like Steve Martin and Buck Henry, and it was a huge failure. And around that time, he co-wrote the movie Three Amigos that people remember, starring Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, and Martin Short. But he was not really a powerful guy. He was not an intimidating force by that point. It took a while for him to rebuild into a mogul. And as successful as SNL was in the late 80s with those great casts, it really wasn't until the movie Wayne's World became a huge hit that Lorne Michaels once again became an extremely powerful entity. Wayne's World made him really the mogul that he is today. Just like anybody in show business, even after his initial triumph with the first 5 years of SNL, Lorne Michaels struggled for a while. But once again, yeah, he is now maybe the most powerful man in all of comedy.
Not only does he have Saturday Night Live, but he has The Tonight Show and Late Night.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It is kind of amazing. And it's interesting how that developed, because when the whole Letterman-Leno thing happened in the early 90s and that 12:30 time slot was empty, NBC did not know who to replace Letterman with. They didn't know who they wanted in that time slot. And Wayne's World had just come out and it was such a success, and now Lorne Michaels was so powerful, that they really deferred to Lorne. It was really up to him because they did not have a comedian in place. So when they were trying to sell the 12:30 Late Show to buyers and affiliates, instead of having a comedian as the star, they had not yet settled on Conan O'Brien, they used Lorne Michaels as the star. They told affiliates that we're going to have a great show at 12:35 every night. We don't know who the host is, but Lorne Michaels, the great, powerful Lorne Michaels, is in charge. And they use that as the selling point to advertisers and affiliates.
There's an amazing story you have in the book here, which I'd like you to share part of with my audience, about what you call the most expensive talk show failure in television history.
Oh, yes, yes.
a show that starred Jerry Lewis.
Yes.
And I've never read a story about a TV megalomaniac like him. It's startling. Please tell us some of it.
Sure, yeah. Well, in 1962, when NBC signed Johnny Carson for The Tonight Show, he was still under contract to ABC Television to host a game show, and ABC, competing network, would not release him from his nightclub contract. So because of that, they had a bunch of guest hosts between the time that Jack Parr left The Tonight Show and between the time Johnny Carson started. And among the many guest hosts that they had was Jerry Lewis. And Jerry Lewis surprised everybody because nobody thought he could host a talk show, but he ended up having the highest ratings in Tonight Show history, outdrawing Steve Allen and Jack Parr, both of who had been extremely popular Tonight Show hosts. So after Jerry Lewis guest hosted, all three of the networks offered him some sort of a deal. They wanted to sign him up. Now, NBC was remiss because they had signed Johnny Carson, and they wondered if they had made a mistake. But ABC finally lured Jerry Lewis over with a ridiculous contract worth millions of dollars, several years, and full creative control for his own Saturday night talk show, 2 hours in length, live. And when they held the press conference for the announcement, journalists asked Jerry Lewis, what are you going to be doing for 2 hours live on the air? And Jerry Lewis was very evasive. He said, well, if my guests are loose, I'll be loose. If my guests are combative, I'll be combative. I guess we'll do some songs and we'll do some comedy. Like, it was really vague. But as the countdown came to the launch of the show, he remained that vague. He never had a game plan. And because he had full creative control, nobody could really tell him what to do. So they paid for this enormous renovation at 1735 Vine Street in a theater that is still there to this day. And they renamed it the Jerry Lewis Theater, and they engraved all the brass fittings in the entire theater with Jerry Lewis's caricature, with his initials JL. They built a fireplace upstairs outside that had speakers coming out of the brick and mortar that blared the show. They erected this giant screen in the balcony to improve sight lines. They built this new desk on the stage that Jerry Lewis would sit at, where he could control and override all the director's shots and change camera angles and cue people. But then when the show premiered, the night that it premiered in 1963, everything went wrong. Jerry Lewis came through the curtain with his Brill cream in his hair glistening. He sang the song When You're Smiling, but there was deafening feedback. The cameras went out. The lights stopped working. There were all these cameos set up for people to drop in and wish him luck, but then when they tried to walk through the door on the set, it wouldn't open. The screen up in the balcony that was to improve the sight lines failed, and half the audience upstairs walked out. It was a huge, huge disaster, and the next morning the reviews were just vicious. TV Guide or Time Magazine, that's what it was. Time Magazine said something like, ABC apparently thinks that America wants to watch 2 hours of a semi-educated boor, you know. And so it was a huge disaster, but it was a very expensive show. And the ratings plunged. It was supposed to be a several-year series, but it got canceled after the 10th episode, and a total of 13 aired. And they had to buy out Jerry Lewis's contract to the tune of almost $10 million in 1963 dollars. And then the next day, they took down the sign that said the Jerry Lewis Theater, and they hired a construction crew to go in there with chisels and scrape off his caricature and initials off of every brass fitting in this enormous theater.
Wow.
So it was one of the most notorious bombs in the history of TV.
What a debacle. I just want to go back to one part of this. I mean, everything you said astounds me, but one thing more than anything else, and that is that there would be a director in the booth who'd be calling the camera shots and all the rest of it, but that at his desk on stage, Jerry could override that and choose different shots than what the director had chosen.
Yeah, I mean,
that's stunning.
What a thankless job it would have been to be the director of the Jerry Lewis show. Could you imagine how terrible that would have been for you?
No, you're never going to get credit. You're only going to get blame. What a gigantic headache that must have been. Oh,
yeah.
What a great story. I'm talking with Cliff Nesteroff. His book is called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. I'd like to turn our attention now to one of my all-time favorites, Albert Brooks. I mentioned that I listened to his albums, Comedy Minus One, and others. I was a big fan of his movies, from Real Life to Modern Romance to Lost in America to Defending Your Life. And then some of the stuff he did later on. I even remember him doing a great job as a serious actor in Taxi Driver for Martin Scorsese. But
sure.
What I didn't know was that the many times I had seen him on TV were some of the first appearances he'd made in front of audiences. Has there ever been a comedian who got on television without doing stand-up gigs first?
Yeah, there was I shouldn't say television. Bob Newhart is a good example because he had a comedy record before he ever really did stand-up. Bob Newhart's first comedy record is his first ever stand-up performance in a nightclub.
Was that The Button Down Mind?
The Button Down Mind. His first record, he had been a disc jockey in Chicago with this guy, Dan Sorkin, and they were sort of doing Bob and Ray-inspired routines on the radio. And when Warner Brothers came through town, Dan Sorkin said, I'm going to record you and give these tapes to Warner Brothers. And so he did, and Warner Brothers liked them, and they said, well, when's your next gig? We'll record you. And Bob Newhart said, I don't have a next gig. I've never done stand-up before. So they booked him into a nightclub in Houston called the Tidelands. And they had three shows that night to do three different recordings to choose the best one or to mix and match. The first show was unusable because Bob Newhart was so nervous he was trembling and shaking. The second one was unusable because through the whole routine, a woman was heckling in the audience. And then the third show was the one that ultimately became the record that they pressed, The Button Down Mind. So I don't think that had happened before, where a complete amateur comedian not only records his act on record his very first time, but that it becomes an enormous best-selling comedy album.
Won the Grammy Award that year.
Yeah, it did. It's just unbelievable to realize that he was such a novice at the time.
Yeah.
And you're right that Albert Brooks had done stand-up on TV first and then went into nightclubs. He was really strange. He was almost like a fully formed entity before he had any experience, Albert Brooks. And he used to say that, and eventually he did start doing nightclubs as an opening act for people like Neil Diamond and Leo Sayer and Richie Valens. But he was really interesting in the regard that he said he never got nervous on stage. He was 18, 19, 20 years old and completely confident, went on stage like he'd been in show business his whole life until about 3 or 4 years into his career. One night he went up on stage in Boston, and all that fear and anxiety and nerves that a young comedian would normally experience in their first year suddenly came flooding through him, flowing through him. Albert Brooks was overwhelmed with nervousness and anxiety and could barely go on stage, and that was the last time he ever did stand-up. He was mortified by the feeling it gave him. It was like this crazy multiple-year delay that most comedians would have experienced right away, and he never returned to the stage.
Wow. I recall seeing him on multiple Carson appearances. And he always had a new bit ready for Carson. And sometimes it would just be a couple of weeks after his previous appearance. It wasn't like, you know, a star now comes in when they have a movie every year or two.
Right.
Carson would have Brooks on and other guests like him every couple of weeks. And so he would have to continually come up with new material. And it was always fresh. But what always got me was how much Carson seemed to be looking forward to it and had no idea what to expect from him.
Albert Brooks was one of those guests that the hosts trusted. They knew he would always deliver. Albert Brooks' first TV appearances were mostly with Steve Allen, who had the same approach. He just let Albert come on and do whatever he wanted. They didn't really do pre-interviews. It was always some new gimmick. And you're right, he always brought something fresh to the floor. He never repeated the same things. Every time he did TV, he came up with a new concept or idea. After I did Mark Maron's show a couple of years ago, I had the good fortune that a lot of people started mailing me very rare things, and this one guy sent me a bootleg disc of like 30 appearances Albert Brooks did on Larry King's Mutual Radio Show.
Oh yeah,
throughout the 1980s, and it's just as you're saying, it was something completely different every single time, and hilarious. Albert Brooks was just a very inventive guy. He had and does have an artistic temperament. He totally thrives on creating and creating something new and fresh. And a lot of stand-up comedians don't do that. You know, they create a 45-minute routine and they do it for the rest of all time. But not Albert Brooks. He always came up with something new and fresh for every single TV appearance, for every single radio appearance, and was always hilarious.
I remember hearing Brooks call in just on a whim to that overnight show that Larry King did on Mutual Radio. I was doing early morning radio at the time, so I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I would listen to that on my way into going and doing my morning drive show. And sometimes there would be a call, and Larry King's producer wouldn't even tell him that it was Albert Brooks. He would just go, you know, let's go to Tony in Des Moines. And he would go to Tony, and it was actually Brooks either doing a voice or a shtick of some kind for 2 or 3 minutes. He got his kicks out of doing that in the middle of the night.
Right, right, absolutely. And then, of course, you'd be inundated with that notorious Larry King cackle.
Yeah.
There's almost nobody made him laugh as hard as Albert Brooks.
I want to go back to Bob Newhart for just a moment here, because there's been a long-time controversy for some in the comedy community, and certainly for one man, about Bob Newhart and the whole concept of doing shtick as one part of a phone conversation, which is really how he became famous. And aside from his TV sitcoms, that is the Bob Newhart shtick. Or is it really Shelley Berman's shtick, since I think he was doing it first? Can you clear that up?
Well, yeah, it's sort of interesting. It's odd if it's a coincidence. They're both from Chicago. Shelley Berman and Bob Newhart are both from Chicago. They both had comedy records, 59, 1960. They both sat on stools while they performed. They both chain-smoked cigarettes while they performed. They both did a driving instructor routine, and they both spoke into imaginary telephones.
Mm.
Shelley Berman claims that Bob Newhart stole his act, but Bob Newhart never, ever did any of Shelley Berman's material, so he really did not steal his act. Had he been stealing his routines and reciting them, then that would be a different thing. But like I say, Bob Newhart was an amateur comedian when he did his first record, and most amateur comedians are either influenced or emulating their favorite comedian. So it's not unusual for somebody to pattern themselves after somebody else who they admire. Woody Allen, when he started, he patterned his material off of people like Nichols and May and Bob Hope, his hero. But that doesn't mean that Woody Allen was stealing Bob Hope's act or Nichols and May's act. He was simply influenced by them. A contemporary comedian like Norm Macdonald is extremely influenced by David Letterman, believe it or not, but he is not going up on stage and doing David Letterman's jokes. He's simply influenced by him. So I believe that Bob Newhart was very much influenced by Shelley Berman, who was the biggest comedian at the time that Bob Newhart did his first gigs. And yeah, it's a bit strange that they're both talking into imaginary telephones, but really, if you break it down, most stand-up comedians these days are doing the same approach. They're all standing up. They're all kind of conversing with the audience off the top. They take the microphone. They say, "How you guys doing?" But that doesn't mean that the guy who's saying, "How you guys doing?" is ripping off somebody else who said, "How you guys doing?" It's just a similar style. So I believe that Bob Newhart did not steal anything from Shelley Berman. Shelley Berman believes that Bob Newhart did steal from him. But when it comes right down to it, he never took any of his material. He never did any of his routines. Now, if he had done that, then you'd have a case and say, well, he's stealing from Shelley Berman. But I don't believe that.
So you're telling me it's the same as when two movies come out about an asteroid coming to impact the Earth, that the studios actually came up with that independently and it's just a coincidence?
Well, that I don't know if that's a coincidence.
Let's talk about comedians as writers. You mentioned in the book, and I didn't, I knew that Steve Martin had written for the Smothers Brothers. I did not know he wrote for Sonny and Cher. But of course, there's a history of Woody Allen and Mel Brooks having been writers for Sid Caesar. And you talk about Louis C.K., who is probably one of the hottest comedians in the world right now, who was a very influential comedian himself as a writer in late night for Conan O'Brien, right?
Yeah, he was one of the first crop of writers for Late Night with Conan O'Brien in 1993. He was hired by Robert Smigel, who people know best as Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. And he was not just influential as a writer, but also a performer on that show. If you were to go back on YouTube and try and watch early sketches on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, you see a clean-shaven Louis C.K. all over the place. He was very influential there. He created a lot of their recurring bits, as did Robert Smigel. Bob Odenkirk was also on that writing staff. And Louis C.K. had been recommended to the people at Conan, including Smigel, by Jeff Garlin, who people know from Curb Your Enthusiasm. It was all part of this Chicago scene that was going on at the time. Jeff Garlin was part of it. Andy Richter was part of it. Jane Lynch and Amy Sedaris were part of that scene. They weren't part of the Conan thing, but they were all in Chicago at that time. So was Amy Poehler. And actually, when the UCB people moved from Chicago to New York, they became a bit of a repertory company for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And some of Amy Poehler's first television appearances are in sketches on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. So there was this big Chicago connection that these people were coming out of. And Louis C.K. was from Boston, but he was doing the stand-up circuit at the time. And like I say, it was Jeff Garlin who recommended to the Conan people that maybe they should check out this kid, Louis C.K. And they hired him, and he was one of their primary writers for a year until David Letterman caught wind of the comedy that was being written over there and lured Louis C.K. to come over and write for him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so there was a famous Sweeps Weeks installment of the early Late Show with David Letterman where they went to the U.K., and did a week's worth of shows, and that was the same week that Louis C.K. got hired. So he was there that week writing that stuff. But Louis was a stand-up at heart, and he did not enjoy his time writing for The Late Show with David Letterman because that was not his ambition. His ambition was to do stand-up on The Late Show with David Letterman, not to write on Late Show with David Letterman. So he really did not have a good time there because of that. It was not exactly what he had had in mind.
Gotcha. The last thing I want to talk to you about, Cliff, is a controversy that's reared its head in the last couple of years. Let me preface it by saying I don't really go to comedy clubs anymore unless somebody like Jake Johansson is coming and playing at the Funny Bone, which is right downstairs from the radio station. But I do go see stand-ups who are performing in theaters now, people whose careers I've known for 20 years or more, like Kathleen Madigan and Brian Regan and even Louis C.K. When they come, I'll go see him in a 2,000 or 3,000 seat auditorium and kind of bask in the fact that their careers have gotten to this point and they can play such big places and sell them out. I think it's great. But we've had a controversy recently with comedians and college campuses. Jerry Seinfeld, who I think America would agree is about the least offensive comedian you can have on stage, has said that he won't go out and do college campuses anymore because of too much political correctness. Chris Rock, who does say some things that would offend people, agrees. And some other comedians have also said that college campuses, which at one time were a great place for stand-ups to play, have changed in that way. Have you talked to anybody about that?
Well, they're still a great place for a stand-up comedian to play. But I will say this. I love Jerry Seinfeld, but he's 60 years old now. And a college campus is not a great place for a 60-year-old to play, because a college audience is 19 years old, and people that are 19 do not want to listen to a 60-year-old man.
So he should play the Mirage in Las Vegas or the Peabody Opera House here in St. Louis, but maybe not go out on the campus.
A comedian speaks to their generation. A comedian relates to their generation. So there's this weird tragedy where some of our favorite comedians, the older they get, we continue to love them, but a generation that's younger than us no longer responds or connects to them. The older a comedian gets, the more of a square or unfunny they seem to be to people that are younger. They don't become square or unfunny to those of us who have followed their career since they've been in their 20s and we've been in their 20s. But for the next generation of people that comes along, they become a little bit of a, not a pariah, but they're not the kind of comedy they're interested in. So kids that are 19, 20, 21, they want to listen to somebody like Bo Burnham, who's around the same age. And the older Jerry Seinfeld gets, the more of a disconnect there's going to be with that younger generation. So that whole controversy with Jerry Seinfeld was predicated on this one joke he did, in which he did a gesture with his pinky up in the air that was interpreted as sort of a gay stereotype. Now, it wasn't necessarily anything that was particularly offensive, you know, it was a pretty innocuous thing, but he was performing for an audience of kids that are now coming up in an era where gay rights and things like that are acceptable and the mainstream. and even a hint of anything that may be considered homophobia, and I don't think Jerry Seinfeld's homophobic at all, but anything that even hints at that, they have been weaned in a culture where they know that's no longer acceptable, whereas Jerry Seinfeld is weaned in a culture from an era when it was. So it's not unlike the 1960s. Bob Hope became very unfashionable with young people, but he continued to be extremely popular with people that were of Bob Hope's generation or people that were raised with Bob Hope. And it's really kind of a sad thing in comedy. This always happens. There's a few exceptions, but the older a comedian gets and the younger society is in relation to that comedian, the more likely they're to dismiss that comedian and say he's old, he's out of touch, he's square, he's not funny. So I don't think it actually had anything to do with political correctness per se, so much as the changing mores of society and then the reaction to that by a new generation. It was like a generational divide. I don't actually think political correctness is the issue here.
So you think a younger guy, say a Jim Jeffries or a Bill Burr, when they go out there, and by the way, non-alliterative comedians as well, but when they go out there, they can get on those stages on college campuses and not feel like they have to watch what they say?
Well, nobody should ever feel like they have to watch what they say, but a good comedian knows how to adjust their material for the audience they're in front of. You have to know how to relate to your audience. When I used to do stand-up, I would do mainstream comedy clubs. I would also do punk rock bars. And I could do some of the same material for both audiences, but there was other material that I knew would make this audience laugh but not the other audience laugh, and vice versa. And a pro knows how to do that. I was a little bit surprised about that Jerry Seinfeld controversy because I think one of the problems was he felt like he didn't get the laugh that the joke deserved.
Yeah.
But the old Jerry Seinfeld of the 70s and 80s, if he did a joke that did not get the desired laugh, he would go back and rewrite it and rework it until he found the laugh or got the desired laugh. And if it never came, he would throw it out because he was a great technician. So I was a little bit surprised. It was really not a great joke one way or the other. It was just a joke, you know. But I felt like the complaint and the grievance was misplaced, and I thought it was almost like an aversion to the changing society. Things have changed. Things have evolved in our culture, and when people who are a little bit older refuse to adjust with that culture, it's difficult. It's frustrating, and there'll be a little bit of blowback. But then those comedians or artists who do adjust to the changing mores of the culture can really sustain themselves. So, for instance, in the 1960s, George Carlin changed his whole tact, and he became the hippies' spokesperson in the 70s, and because of that, became a huge success. He targeted this new important demographic. But maybe if George Carlin had never changed his act, maybe then by 1975 he would have been considered irrelevant and college-age audiences would not want to listen to him.
And you can say the same about Richard Pryor, who was, you know, went on stage looking like the straightest guy in the world, wearing a tie and a suit and all of that. No hint of what he was to become later on, considered by many to be the greatest stand-up of all time.
Almost all the comedians of the 1960s, the ones who endured were guys who reinvented themselves. Bob Newhart reinvented himself as a television star. Richard Pryor, of course, reinvented himself as the rawest, most honest voice for black culture. George Carlin became the spokesman of the hippie culture. But if you think about all the people who did not reinvent themselves, and people like Woody Allen and Mike Nichols left nightclubs and became filmmakers, but the people that did not reinvent themselves, like Shelley Berman, they slowly but surely eroded from the comedy culture, and nobody really cared about them by the 70s or 80s, which is not necessarily fair, but when society evolves and its tastes change, if you want to sustain yourself in show business, you often need to adjust for that.
Cliff Nesteroff's website is Classic Television Showbiz, and the book is called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. It has been a great pleasure talking to you today, Cliff. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.